Well, good morning, everyone. It's lovely for me to be back here this morning, and I really, really appreciate the words of encouragement that so many of you have given to me. I was asked this morning what has been my connection with Avondale College. Actually, goes back quite a long way. I first came here 51 years ago. I was still in high school when the high school was the education building, and I lived in the high school hostel, which was the business department next door. And I was on the faculty here for a few years. I was on the college council for 12 years until I retired. And as I look around this building, the man who built this building and many of the buildings on this campus was Graham Allen, who was my best friend. And he was killed 2 weeks ago riding on his bicycle. And so it has sadness as well as happiness when I stand here. But Avondale is a place that I love very, very much. And it is a privilege for me to be here. I asked somebody once, what was the most revengeful, fearsome creature on the planet? And I was told that it was this creature. Now, you can tell just by looking, he's not exactly saying happy Sabbath. But what is it? Yeah, that quietened you down a bit, didn't it? What is that animal? You're right. The largest animal in the weasel family is the wolverine. And hunters have said that that animal, if you are out in the Canadian wilds or in the steppes of Russia and you upset a wolverine, it would follow you for weeks seeking revenge. So angry, so powerful, and so revengeful that it would tackle anything. And there has been a record of a polar bear that upset a wolverine. Now, you think that a polar bear could upset a wolverine and just go off, but that wolverine followed it and finally killed it. Unfortunately, there are probably creatures that exceed it. Now, here's a nice-looking young man. Young woman, he could be of interest. He's going to go bald. But this picture, here's another picture of him, starting to get sinister. And this picture was taken only yesterday. Yesterday in Norway was the first day of the trial, I get his name right, of Anders Behring Breivik. And he is on trial for murdering 91 people. 77 of which were at a youth camp on an island just near Oslo. And he dressed up as a policeman, went onto the island, and he killed, only in the last 12 months, 77 young people. Here's just a few of them. And when you look at them, it just could be some of you. He, when he went on trial yesterday, he gave the power salute, and there's such hatred, and I don't know what his fate will be, because they examined him to see whether he was sane enough to go on trial, and the government, he could be as silly as a wheel, but that government was going to make sure he stood on trial, and he is now on trial for his life. But I want to tell you a story this morning. I want to talk about forgiveness, but before I can do that, we have to talk about hatred. And it's not exactly a photograph. It could be a because it happened in the Bible. And it is a story of a man who has so much hatred. And his story is quite intriguing because he had hatred and forgiven. His name was Shimei. And David, he was not a perfect man by any means. And some of what Shimei had to say about David was correct. But it was the way he said it, and also the lies that came with it, that has made him remembered in history. And David was a murderer. He was an adulterer. And he lost his kingdom to his own son, Absalom. And David had to leave Jerusalem so quickly that he didn't even have time to put his shoes on. And he crossed the river weeping. And there was something about rivers in the Bible that is very symbolic, that when you cross the river, your state has changed. And he headed up north. He was fleeing. And if you do have your Bibles with you, doesn't really matter, but I've got the story here, and we pick it up in 2 Samuel. And I'm reading from 2 Samuel chapter 16. As King David approached Bahurim, you can imagine how he was feeling. He was very downcast. He loved his son, but his son had deposed him. His kingdom had been taken from him. But as he approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as King Saul, who had been David's predecessor, came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. You've got to give it to him. His anger was so great, he was prepared to take all sorts of risks. And David was walking along a valley. He was not only walking along a valley of despair, he was walking along a real valley. Because when you are fleeing from your life, for your life, you don't walk on the hilltops. You walk along the valleys. And no doubt he spent most of his time looking at the ground, reflecting on the terrible things that had happened in the last few days. And Shimei appears on the hillside. Well, he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officers with stones and anything he could get his hands to. I don't know if you've ever been stoned. I have. The rocks missed me when I was living in Fiji. I have been pelted at by a gorilla in the zoo. And I'll let you guess what he threw at me. But I was pretty angry, and so was the gorilla, apparently. He ignored the troop of soldiers, the few soldiers that David had left, and he followed him along the hillside, and he cursed him as he went. He said, "Get out! Get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel! The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has also handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You have come to ruin because you are a man of blood." Well, I think he got his point across. There were three false accusations just in that text that I read. One, he didn't murder Saul. Saul committed suicide. David could have taken Saul's life on a number of occasions. He even crept into the cave. He must have been pretty quiet of foot. He got past the guards around Saul and got to the sleeping man in the middle of the night. He could have taken his life like that. But instead he cut off a little bit of his coat. And when he was safely on the other side of the ravine, he called out to Saul. He said, "Saul, I could have killed you. Here is part of your clothing." And Saul quickly has a look around, and he realizes that David has been in that cave. And David even repented that he had cut the clothes of God's anointed. He never killed Saul. And he said, "You have stolen the throne from Saul." He never did. He was only a young teenager when God told Samuel to anoint him and declare him to be the new king of Israel because of Saul's failings. And the third one was, he said, you have given your, God has taken your throne and given it to Absalom. God did not take the throne from David. Absalom stole it. Well, David has some brave soldiers, and one of them was Abishai, who is his nephew. And he said, let me just go across there and I'll cut his head off and bring it back to you. Now, it would have been fairly tempting, although I have no real desire to see a body without a head or a head without a body. And David said, leave him be. I don't know why this is happening. It may even be God's will because of some of the things that I have done, but do not touch him. And Shimei followed him all the way, throwing things, taunting him, calling him names, and the bodyguard around David, their hands were clutching their swords. They would love to have gone off and taken his head, and David said, don't touch him. What a way to treat somebody who was hating you so visibly at that moment. But you know, in politics, things can change. And Absalom died. And David was restored to the throne. Then there was a real kerfuffle because all those who had declared their allegiance to Absalom thought, well, we better go and make things right. And right at the head was Shimei. And he came screaming down the hillside. This is a few months later. We read here, this is in chapter 19. Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. Again, crossing the river is very symbolic in the Bible. Shimei, son of Gera the Benjamite, from the same tribe, of course, as Saul, he came scuttling down. Scuttling's not in the Bible. And with him, he brought 1,000 Benjamites, along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan where the king was, and they crossed at the ford. And Shimei crossed the Jordan. He fell on his face, prostrate before the king, and he groveled. He thought his speech out quite carefully, because this is what he said. He said, may the Lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind, for I, your servant, I know that I have sinned. But today I have come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my lord the king. And Abishai, he said, don't believe in him. Let me knock him off. And David forgave Shimei. He said, I will spare your life. He extended grace. Actually, this story is, every story in the Old Testament relates to the New Testament and relates to the plan of salvation. It represented God's forgiving attitude. David forgave Shimei even though he knew Shimei's groveling apology was probably based on the need to survive than on genuine repentance. And here is a lesson for us. You know, I fail God repeatedly. And God knows my beginning to my end. There's something I want you to understand, that every time you are about to sin and you are being tempted, God treats you as though he expects you to do the right thing. In my case, he knows that I will sin. He knows I confess bitterly what I have done. He knows that by this time tomorrow I might do the same thing. But he opens up his arms and he says, my son, I forgive you. I will treat you as though you've never done it. And that is why we are told that the science of salvation will be the study of eternity. It'll take us that long to even begin to understand the depth of God's love, his tolerance, and his forgiveness. And yet we live in a world that says God doesn't care. We live in a world that says God doesn't even exist. Well, David finally came to the end of his life. And he said to his son Solomon, who was to succeed him, he said, I promised that Shimei would live and I'll leave it to you, but I know that he probably is not completely repentant. And so Solomon said to Shimei, you can live here in Jerusalem, build your house here, but I'm putting you under some sort of home detention. As long as you stay here in the city, you will be safe. But if ever you run away from the city, you will die. Shimei listened very carefully, and for 2 years he did the right thing, and he didn't go away. But one day, two of his servants cleared off, and in a moment of madness, he got on a donkey and chased them. And when he got back, Solomon was waiting for him. And so was Abishai, who had twice wanted to cut off Shimei's head. And Solomon said, you disobeyed, and you're going to pay the price. You had a safe haven, you chose to leave it. You did, and now you will pay the price because that we promised you. And Abishai, I don't know whether he chopped his head off, but he certainly killed him. You know, nothing will erode your spiritual experience or my spiritual experience than an unforgiving spirit. There is hatred, and then there is its more subtle form called resentment. I don't know about you, but I'm very susceptible to resentment. Why do I resent people? You know, many of you have given your hearts to God and you walk closely with Him, and yet Satan uses resentment because it is so cunning, it is so sneaky, and it builds in. You know, last night we spoke about the superwoman of the Bible, Mary Magdalene, and how when Christ confronted Simon, who had been the start of all of Mary's problems, how easy it would have been to say, I resent you because I have been working with this poor girl and you were the start of it all, and I can read your heart and I know that you are not really sorry. But instead of that, Christ set us an example. He looked forward and he said, I could crush you. I could expose you at this party that you are throwing, but instead, I'm going to try and save your soul. And he did, with his gentle approach, and nobody knew what he was saying except Simon. A few years ago, I was in London and staying with my daughter and her husband, and I was lying in bed one morning. Yeah, there was only one bed. It was a nice double bed, and Felicity and Brad were sleeping on the couch. Anyhow, I was listening to television, and I heard that the world's greatest living treasure was going to speak in a couple of hours' time in Trafalgar Square. And I thought, this is fantastic. And I leapt up, had a shower, got dressed, and out the door, onto the underground to get in to see and hear the world's greatest living treasure. If I was to ask you, who is the world's greatest living treasure, who would you say? By the way, if you say One Direction, you will be escorted from the building. apart from your mother, if I was to ask you, in the year 2012, who is the most visibly significant living treasure in this world, who would you say? Oh, thank you for really yelling the answer at me. Take a guess. She has actually been a wonderful person and has carried with great dignity all the years, the 60 years of her reign. And it's not a bad guess. She is a living treasure. The Queen, however, doesn't speak in Trafalgar Square. Well, I got to Trafalgar Square, and to my horror, I took this photo. I reckon there was 10,000 people there, and I was at the back. And I wanted to get as close as possible to hear the words coming from the lips of who I regarded to be the world's greatest living treasure. Now, I love the Poms, and if there's a Pom here, please don't be offended, but there is something about them. They have a naivety that the Aussies don't have, because I reached into my wallet, I took out my driver's license, I held it above my head, and I yelled, "Press! Press! Media! Media!" And those dear, loving people, it was like the Red Sea. They just opened up. And to my astonishment, I not only got to the front of the crowd, I was in the press box. Now, and here they are with these great things with these monstrous lenses, and I had this dinky little camera like that. And I was so surprised, and we're still waiting. You look at that crowd, it is 20 minutes before the speaker was to appear. Every eye is focusing at the stage. When I got there, I took a photo looking back. And they're still looking, except for this guy here who looks a bit cabbagey at me. And I think my daughter and her husband are right up the back there. Under one of those flags. But even in that photo, you'll notice that they're not looking at me, just this bloke that I've upset. They're all looking past me, and there's another 20 minutes to go. Now, who was it? It was this man, Nelson Mandela. Look, I wasn't lying when I said I was in the press box. Look at it. There's cameras and reporters. I'm right down the middle. And at the end, he came down. He's an old man. He's got a walking stick there. And he's nearly blind. He came down and he walked between me and the stage there. And for some reason, he looked at me and he said, "Hello." And I got my camera. Do you want to see the picture I took? I never took one. I was so astonished that Nelson Mandela would talk to me, and away he went. He is a living treasure because he was prepared for his beliefs, and their political beliefs, on behalf of the black people of South Africa, to spend 27 years in that cell. You can touch both sides of it. 27 years on Robben's Island. And the reason his vision isn't too good is because when he wasn't in the cell, he was outside in the courtyard cracking rocks by the white men with guards and guns, cracking rocks with a small hammer. 27 years. Most of you are not even 27 years of age. It is a huge hunk out of your life. Nelson Mandela said something during his speech that has really stuck in my mind. That man, when he got out of prison, he became the president of South Africa. He could have unleashed a terrible bloodbath of revenge. He could have been a shimei. But instead, he said, "I want peace in this country." You know, a couple of years ago, he had an operation on his eyes. And South Africa quivered because they knew that if he were to die during that operation, South Africa could become unstable. He is a very old man now in his 90s, but the world still wonders what is going to happen when Nelson Mandela passes away. But this is what he said. And it's such a powerful thing. Resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies. You know, we can resent for a number of reasons. We can resent the way we've been treated in life by a person or by an institution or by a group of people. And you start off with a little bit of hurt. And then your mind just dwells on it and it becomes resentment. And folk, that just erodes your spiritual life. You can feel resentment because of your lot in life. You're born in poverty. You weren't given the opportunities that other people have who come from richer families. People can feel resentment about the way nature designed you to look, your shape, your talents. You look at other people and you say, I wish I could be like you. And then resentment comes in. It is the devil's subtle weapon. Satan is continually trying to destroy our relationship with God. And to those of you who don't know God, he uses resentment and hatred. To those of you that are committed to God, he knows that is the thin edge of the wedge that can start to erode your experience. I've had a number of difficult jobs in my life, and 8 years of which were being principal of boarding schools. And it is a tough gig, I'll tell you. They run with the principal and then the discipline committee and the staff committees, and you have all these rules. And the more complicated you make a rule, the more the chance that somehow somebody's going to fall between the gaps and an innocent person is going to be punished in a way that they might not have really deserved. And it is so difficult to run a boarding school. Well, a young man, we'll call him Eric. He got caught up in it. And the discipline committee decided that they had to suspend him for 2 weeks. And we did realize it was a marginal case, but that if he wasn't suspended, that it would make it difficult to make the rules work in the future. So I said, well, I'll leave it with me. I'll speak to him. Now, I could have picked up the phone, but being full of foolish courage, I said, oh, I'll go around to the house. I went around to the house in the evening. You know, dogs are very sensitive as to whether someone is an enemy or a friend. Well, this one picked it up real fast and growled at me from underneath the house. And so I went up and knocked on the door. They came in and they were shocked because when you get a knock on the door and it's the principal there, you know that he's not there to give you flowers. And I said, I just need to speak to you. And I told them what had happened. And I said, Eric, you're going to have to take 2 weeks off. There was so much anger in that room. I really thought that I was going to be assaulted on the spot. And when I left the house a few minutes later, I fully expected the seat of my pants to be bitten out by the dog because they've only had to say one word. And Eric came back to school a fortnight later, and I saw him in class, and I just saw resentment. Well, it was the first day of a new term, and we set up a new program that every day we would select two students, and we would pray for them. And I had said, well, that's very good, but it's really not effective unless the students know that we've prayed for them. And I'm going to pray for them. And guess who was on my list for the very first day? It was Eric. And whenever I walked along the school corridors that day and I saw Eric, I saw resentment. You have wronged me. And I really felt quite bad about it. And I made a decision that, well, perhaps it's not the right time. Maybe I should leave it a week. And then I'll call Eric in. But as he was leaving to go home from school, and I'd been wrestling with this all day, the Holy Spirit got me off my desk and he said, go and get Eric. As he went past the door, I said, Eric, can you step in for a minute? He came in wondering what was going to happen next, and he sat there in front of me, and I said, Eric, this morning we prayed for you. And I said, you are sitting here, and I can tell by the look on your face you are not enjoying being in my presence. And maybe you hate me. And if you do, you might have a good reason. And if I have offended you beyond the call of my duty, I beg your forgiveness. And I said, I'm going to ask you a favor. And you don't have to say yes, but are you prepared to kneel down with me? And let me pray for you. Well, I looked at his face and I saw a struggle going on. And finally, he put on a bit of bravado and he said, oh yeah. And we knelt down, put my arm on his shoulder, and I prayed a short prayer and asked that God would bless his life. I let him go, and as I saw him get on his bike and go off, I thought, well, I wonder whether I've really blown it this time. Is his resentment so great that it was totally inappropriate? Well, a few months later, he asked me if I'd come to his baptism. And at his baptism, he acknowledged that it was that moment on his knees in the principal's office where Satan wrestled with him, but God won. I've got a beautiful text to finish with. It comes from Luke chapter 23. And when they came to the place that is called a skull, there they crucified him. And the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they cast lots to divide his garments.